Hello, and welcome back to Lost in Citations, our regular podcast where we speak to the producers of interesting content and see if we can learn a little bit more about their background. Joining us today is Joe Vitter, who is, for now, for the next, 36 hours, a associate professor at Kyushu University. So very nice to speak to you today, Joe.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
And this is a continuing of my lunchtime series. This is not actually being recorded during lunchtime because Joe is in a bit of a hurry to get through a lot of other work that you have to do, and you're leaving us. You're going to Waseda University.
I am, yeah. So from April 1st, I will be there.
Very sorry to for you to leave, but it's been nice to work with you for the last 3 years.
3 years, yeah.
3 years, and don't be a stranger.
I won't be. It's been nice working with you as well.
Thank you very much. Well, the paper we're speaking about today is Academic Word Difficulty and Multidimensional Lexical Sophistication, an English for Academic Purposes Focused Conceptual Replication of Hashimoto and Egbert from 2019. English for Academic Purposes, it's not a new field, and it's certainly something that turns up in TESOL courses. And so could you give us some background to your interest in this field and your background of
EAP, which is the acronym for English for Academic Purposes, is something that I've had experience with off and on probably since 2011, and that's when I first began to work at Sukmyung Women's University. And
that's in Korea, yes?
Yes, okay. That's in Seoul. And what makes EAP unique, I think, it's one of the first domains of English teaching where there's a very strong, or at least to my understanding, one of the first domains where there was a very strong connection to linguistic theory. Hmm. So M.A.K. Holiday, I forget how that's pronounced. He wrote specifically about EAP and about language learning for academic purposes. And it fit into his functional kind of theory, which is to say that if we understand language in terms of text type, then it makes sense to have a specific domain for all those text types which are academic by nature. Mm. And that's where my experience with EAP kind of comes from, which is that I look at it in terms of a output type of thing, where when we teach EAP, it can be a specific course, but it could also be components of courses. Mm. So, for example, if you think about our shared work together at Kyushu University, there are courses that are not EAP by design, but they have EAP components to them, right? So, for example, we need to teach our students how to listen to lectures and to answer questions about them. Hmm. I won't get into this specific course names, obviously, okay, right. but the point is this, I guess my interest in EAP comes from practice first, because it was something that I was asked to do. And then as my academic career progressed, it became something that I would research from time to time. So I have a paper that was published in RELC in 2017, where I looked at the management of EAP writing courses. And then as somebody who's interested in vocabulary, lexical sophistication, this was kind of a natural thing for me to latch onto and for me to follow up on, of course, with my two co-authors.
And your co-authors are from Korea, from Japan, USA?
It's an interesting question. So Chris Nicklin, I knew from my time at Rikkyo, which is before I came to Kyushu University. Simon Albright is someone I knew from my days in Saudi Arabia. Mm-hmm. And where we got to collaborate on this project is that we kind of needed to build a multi-site and multi-nation sample to make the paper more impactful. Mm. And that's where Simon came into play. So he was able to get us access to Saudi EAP students. And that helped us build the sample that we wanted to for this paper.
I have other questions about the paper specifically, but I just want to ask you now, because you're someone who really understands this concept of impact and of academic papers. So was this a conscious effort to try and recruit people who, like multinational people, that is going to help your paper get a wider reach?
Yes.
I was reviewing it on ResearchGate yesterday, and it's already been cited several times. Do you think that this is something that is this a recommendation of yours for perhaps young academics trying to establish themselves in various fields? They should
absolutely
network and
Yeah. So to answer your question directly, yes. I think that young academics, all academics, should take advantage of collaboration to build the most robust investigative processes they can. I'm a quantitative researcher, so that comes down to sample construction. And now I will say, with this specific paper, we replicated a very good paper. The paper that we replicated was excellent. And I've done a project with Brett Hashimoto recently. So some replications are done because they think there was an error with the original study.
Right.
This is not the case. We really liked the first paper and we wanted to continue with what they did. The original study, Hashimoto and Egbert 2019, had a multinational sample. So they had ESL learners from the States. They had EFL learners from Mexico. Again, I don't have the paper in front of me. Let's just take it. But it was multinational. So to replicate that, we needed a multinational sample. And we thought, well, we're interested in Asian EAP. Why not do a Japanese subsample with a Saudi subsample? And the stats behind the sampling worked out so that we could justify it. So that was good.
And given that it is a replication study, do you feel that you got the information that you wanted, whether it was whether it confirmed or denied or brought up other questions? Do you think you got from it what you wanted?
Yeah, so... The original study took on a very fundamental question that relates to English teachers, to language teachers, which is that is frequency sufficient for the purposes of organizing vocabulary in terms of how we present it, in terms of how we test it, in terms of how we teach it?
Mm.
And what the original study concluded was that frequency is not enough. It was a simple phrase that they said, more than frequency. And we found that as well. And what that has led to, the work that I'm involved in at present, is how can we organize vocabulary using frequency with other factors, maybe trying to replace frequency with things like teacher judgments, coupled with things like L2 prevalence, which is like a crowdsourced thing that Brisbane and colleagues made. So yeah, I mean, we did find what we wanted to, but it's one of those things where the research is ongoing. And what makes this a very interesting topic is that there are conceptual debates that mean that we're never really going to settle it. So, we will, hopefully, but it's one of those things where it's not going to be settled soon.
Right.
So one of the things that we did was we said, we think that age of acquisition should be in this model. And age of acquisition, just to remind people what that is, words are judged by native speakers in relation to the age when they thought that they acquired it, right? So a word like, you know, pizza would have a very low age of acquisition. A word like souffle or something like that might have a higher one. And
these are judged, you say, by L1 speakers, by...
Yeah, it can be done both ways. It can be done by L1 speakers.
Right.
It can be done by homogeneous L2 speakers. So some researchers, such as De Wilde, have taken the time to go to Dutch learners, present them English words, and say, well, when did you learn this word?
Yes.
The problem with the L2 approach is that, not the problem, because some people support it and don't like the L1 approach, but with the L2 approach, you're going to be limited in how you can use that variable. So if I make a L2 Japanese data set, it only really applies to Japanese learners. Mm. The advantage of the L1 data set is I could use it anywhere. But Hashimoto is someone who I've talked about this. He would critique the L1 use. He would critique using L1 by saying, well, your learners are not native English speakers.
Right.
And you know, where you might turn on, where you might turn back on that is to say, well, frequency comes from L1 users as well. So we have to have something. And Age of Acquisition has a conceptual, or let's say a theoretical role in that it speaks to the number of exposures one needs to acquire the word or to master the word. So that's one of the things that we talk about in the paper.
Mm.
Pizza has a low frequency score, but it's a easy word.
Mm-hmm.
Frequency alone can't speak to the difficulty of pizza. Age of Acquisition helps to justify why pizza is a A1 or A2 word on the Cepher, and why a word like physics, which is actually more frequent, would be a B1 word.
So. Well, just to give some context to our non-Japanese listeners to this, pizza in Japan is also pizza in Japan.
Right, right, right.
So you would see it on a menu, you would see it on a board somewhere, you would see it on a sign.
Right.
More often than you would see souffle,
right,
to use your example. So the number of times of incidental contact with the word is likely to make it easier for you to understand if you were hearing it,
for example.
So it's why words like pizza, but also things like curry, high incidence foreign turn up in textbooks, way more than possibly similar incidents. I don't know rank. Not to explain, but rank order vocabulary would, in an L2 context in Japan.
Right. And this discussion is where this paper is situated.
Right.
And that we wanted to kind of apply techniques that were developed before this paper to answer a focused question about word difficulty and how we can understand what predicts word difficulty, because any teacher knows that how we present vocabulary, how we organize vocabulary is fundamental to what we do.
Mm.
And any teacher knows that textbooks can often get it wrong.
Mm.
And textbooks, by and large, use frequency.
Mm.
Right. And I think that's where this work and others, because we're not the only team working on this, but where researchers who are interested in this this is how we are contributing to the field, because there is a desire to have ways besides frequency to organize vocabulary and to drive how we test it.
Yeah, I mean, I still use LexTutor.ca as a way of deciding, because, you know, looking at K1, K2, so the first thousand, the second thousand. Things that are on the academic word list, which I think is produced by the University of New South Wales, and anything that's then off book.
Right.
And I use this to decide which words I'm going to focus on, particularly when I was teaching, for example, the QBS course, the Kyushu Business School MBA course, which are the words that are most likely to cause difficulty because they are low incidence.
Right.
What you tend to find is that the low incidence words at that kind of level of work are ones that are basically technical.
Right.
Or the names of companies.
Right.
So a company, let's take a prominent Japanese company like Ajinomoto, which makes food products, is going to be completely off book. It's going to be red, right, highlighted on LexTutor. But it's not necessarily a word that the people in the class are going to be unfamiliar with.
Right.
So it's trying to strike that balance between what, you know, knowing your audience. Right. So, you know, us working in Japan. So if you take Ajinomoto to Venezuela, they're going to have no idea.
Right, right.
But if you take it to another city in Japan, they have no problem,
right,
knowing that. In relation to that, I want to get to the findings of the paper, but my question is, did you feel while you were doing this that there were implications for language teaching and testing in Japan that perhaps hadn't been highlighted by the Hashimoto and Egbert study that you might want to make recommendations for in the future?
That's a good question. I think this is where it becomes, and if we think about the Japanese context, while I believe the country has made great strides in English language proficiency over the last 20 years, something that Rob Warren told me a long time ago, you know, many students here aren't ready for the AWL, which is the academic word list. Mm-hmm. So in terms of nationwide implications, I'm not quite sure, but I would say that in terms of those universities like ours, like others who have students who are ready for academic purpose language learning, I think one of the main implications is that programs need to review how their textbooks and materials are presenting the vocabulary to their students, mm-hmm, with an eye of questioning and confirming the appropriateness of that presentation. And our paper presents a simple three-factor model or three-predictor model featuring frequency, age of acquisition, and word reaction time, word recognition reaction time, that it would be unreasonable to expect a teacher to do this, but a program manager or a department head could be expected to use Kyle's Talus, which is, you know, just a point and click tool to get information about words, and to maybe rank or, you know, at least try to gauge how the target words for the program's learners are being rated by the model that we publish. Now, that is a bit of wishful thinking, to be sure. I'll be the first one to say that. But I think, you know, also if we think about, I think really about, you know, textbook writers, textbook creators, that's where our work probably has the most meaning, because with somebody who's producing a vocabulary textbook or producing a academic reading book, you can expect them to analyze their vocabulary for appropriateness and things like that. And that's where I do think it's interesting, because even the big textbook publishers are really only using frequency, right? For example, Cengage, who I really like Cengage's products.
Me too.
But they advertise that they're just using the university word list, which is a frequency-driven list, right?
Which universities?
It's a published focus. So it's a complement to the AWL. So it's the university word list. It's basically like it's another version of the AWL. I forget part.
What's their corpus? Where are they drawing it from? I'm assuming it's going to be North America or.
I would imagine. I don't know. But I know, just having, because I sat through a sales presentation where they said they use the university word list for vocabulary people. It's just like one of those, what's the word I'm looking for? It's one of those well-known lists that if you need a vocabulary list, you take it off the shelf and it's like, these are the university words.
Well, there was a word list produced, I think, gosh, it's probably like 15 years ago now, the JASA 8000. But it was based on basically an academic word list that was connected to Japan specifically.
Right.
So do you think there's value in each country in an EFL, ESL context deciding which are the most prevalent words to be taught?
Absolutely. I mean, so a paper that we have that's under review, we found that cogniteness, to just remind your listeners what that is, a word like pizza in for a Japanese learner of English would be scored as being a cognate of English, so that the Japanese word and the English word are the same, pronunciation notwithstanding. In a model where we have cognateness in it, it's accounting for 20% of the explained variants. Now, what that's telling us is that you know, vocabulary lists, we do have a desire to be as broad as we can with them, but we also have to be focused for the individual context and things like, you know, is the target word in the learner's first language? Well, that's something that we need to consider. Also, we have the idea that, you know, different learners come from different languages, have different first languages that have different writing systems. And how does that affect the vocabulary that we choose? So, I do think that there is a lot of space to have more contextualized vocabulary lists. And that's where the model that we published can be useful, because all of our variables are English native speaker based. So even though it lacks L2 information, because it lacks L2 information, it's not bound to any L2 group, right?
Now, in your lessons and your we've talked about Cengage, but there are other textbook providers out there who are doing some work. Right. Do you explicitly teach vocabulary, or is this something that you use when selecting the textbook? Like, are you front end or back end focused on where vocabulary comes in your syllabus?
Well, that's an interesting question. When I can, I quiz vocabulary every week, and I did that here. Here being a Kyushu university, as we had the freedom to do that. Because I do think that if you just get learners used to studying vocabulary, interested, then you have the potential to get them interested in words. Mm. And for Japanese learners, with the exception of those at the very top end of the proficiency scale, studying vocabulary is going to be crucial to their proficiency development. And we know that from decades of research. So I think, I think that any teacher in a Japanese, Korean, Chinese context, just thinking about Asian learners, because they're coming from a L1 background that's very different to English, there's always going to be an emphasis on vocabulary development. And I think that's why Japan is known as, you know, ground zero for vocabulary research, because this is the place where the need is greatest and where the payoff is the greatest, right? Mm. So, like, one of the things that is always interesting, and Rob Waring is a part of it especially, any university that has, let's say, an average TOEIC score below 500 or 450 for your listeners, that's an A2 TOEIC, which is common here. A extensive reading program paired with a vocabulary mobile app will usually result in a 50-point bump, right? And that's just because that extra vocabulary that they take on in that 6 months or 12 months is going to let them answer 5 to 6 more questions than they could without it, right? It doesn't matter. Oh, I understand that word. I can answer this question.
Well, I've recently finished an assignment with a very large Department of Education project, which the concept of the difference between the A2 and the B1 when writing items. Now, the content of the test could be in the B1 to B2 range.
Right.
But the item writing had to be A2.
Right.
So could you give us some, I don't want to be the one to explain it. You're the expert in this. What are we talking about when we talk about A2, B1?
Sure.
What is
it? I think we're both experts in this, but so when we talk about A1, A2, B1, and so on, we're talking about the CEFR, which is the Common European Reference for Languages. It was developed, there's a bit of debate as to where it came in the 70s through the noughts. Mm. And really what it is, it's a way to understand proficiency descriptively. Mm. And it's a way to understand proficiency functionally. So if we return to the idea of text type, we would say that a A1 learner can engage with the basic text types for, you know, everyday life, for survival. A A2 learner can deal with more text types than a A1.
Hmm.
And that expansion of functionality is driven in large part by having more vocabulary.
Hmm.
And that's where vocabulary and the CEFR are intertwined.
It's right? Vocabulary and kind of experience.
Vocabulary, that,
I'm allowed to bring up the fact that I was an IELTS speaking assessor for a decade, and now that I'm not doing it anymore, I'm allowed to say it.
Right.
And this was the main problem with assessing candidates who were below the age of about 21. Because they haven't been places, they haven't done things, they haven't met people, they haven't had the various types of interactions. They may have had conversations, but reading an email or reading an academic paper or these different genres of interaction with the language, they just don't have the experience for it.
So
the CEFR kind of in my estimation is kind of, it's aligned with a kind of can-do sort of framework.
But that's where most tests, though, will... So, for example, the main suite, which is how Cambridge tests the CEFR for general usage, every one of their tests will have a four kids... Well, maybe not everyone, but the first three, I know for sure, have a four kids option because of the very issues that you're talking about. I guess, just to complete the thought, though, which is that, there is a notion, though, that the experience that you're talking about, which is 100% valid, is reflected in vocabulary growth.
Correct.
Right? And then where this idea became substantiated, that vocabulary and CEFR advancement or growth or whatever you want to say is aligned, would be the work of Milton and then later, I think, Holsten, because he's a Dutchman, apologies if he's listening to this and I mispronounce his name, but Holsten is how.
If you are listening, by the way, shout out to Mr. Holsten.
But they could show empirically that there were vocabulary size thresholds for different CEFR levels, and that's where everyone latched on to this idea. So Milton showed, for example, I think his estimates are a bit low for my liking, but that a B1, if he had, 2,500 to 3,000 word families, or she had, would be a B1 or B2, like a C1 or C2 might have 3,700. Again, I think those are a bit low, but it was based on empirical work, and Holsten showed that a B1 speaker of Dutch as a foreign language learner had about like 4,000 words, and a B2 had about 8,000 words. So that's where this comes from. Right. And I think that's where this whole area of work, because I know that your podcast has interviewed a lot of vocab guys. It was the work that began in the 90s and the noughts that really kind of said, look, like proficiency growth is tied to vocabulary growth. That a lot of this work has kind of gained its, not importance, but it gained its kind of celebrity, if you will.
Well, we have had Professor Rob Waring on the podcast, actually interviewed by Todd Bukins, I think, they're right, also collaborating. While we're on the topic of Cepha and Cepha J, this is my first time of hearing about Coca.
Sure.
Do they differ much in their ratings of words?
Yes. So the Coca is a corpus. Mm-hmm. And to remind your listeners what that is, it's just a representative database of language. Now, where the Coca is like the Cepha is that the Coca will organize words, and they organize words primarily by lemma and not word. I don't want to get into that debate, but lemma is a smaller unit of a word.
Mm.
So there any iteration of the target word in the same word class would be a lemma. So like go, going, went, or something like that.
Or right? Like referred.
Yeah, you know, so something like that. Right?
And I've done a really bad job of setting this up. The Coca is the corpus of contemporary American English.
And I should have said this, but anyway, sorry. It's fine. So they organize words by lemma, and actually the original study used the Coca.
Mm.
So their target word list came from, I think, it was the first 8,000 word or 5,000 lemmas of the Coca. And basically, so what the Coca does is it, in the sense of leveling, is that it lets teachers take, you know, you mentioned like K1, K2.
Mm.
There would be a Coca equivalent. So like K1 in the Coca would be the first 1,000 lemmas. Mm-hmm. And it's just another way of thinking about it. What makes the Coca list interesting is that because it proceeded the Lex Tutor information,
mm-hmm.
we don't have, as you know, we don't have instantly recallable rules of thumb.
Hmm.
So we know, like, for example, I used Lex Tutor for training I did in Lebanon, well, virtually this summer. And what makes Lex Tutor really great is that everyone knows the rules of thumb.
Hmm.
So if you're like, you need to write a B1 text for a reading kind of section, make sure that at least 5% is K3 or higher, right? And if you have like 2% above K6, there's a problem, right? You know, and
it's the old, as you say, rule of thumb. The idea, yeah, like it's some academics said it, you need to know 95% of the words in order to get the. And some people say 96, yeah. 97, 98, but you know, it's in that area.
And you can apply that easily to the K leveling stuff that it likes, because we all know it.
Mm.
With the Coca, because the limb is smaller,
mm-hmm.
it gets bigger, right? So now you're getting at like 5,000, 6,000, and it has been, you know, mapped out, but not mapped out the way that the word family K levels have.
What you mean by when the lemma is smaller than the number is higher, what you mean is like they restricted the number of, you know, initial case words, thereby expanding the number of possible derivations.
So basically, when we think about K-leveling on LexTutor, it's by word family. Mm-hmm. And to give your listeners who are not vocab people a background, there's a debate which has been raging. It got so hot.
Absolutely
there,
raging.
Yeah, it was. There was actually, it got so hot that SSLA, which is a big journal in the field, Studies in Second Language.
Started a beef with.
They had articles going at each other. It was really funny to read. But anyway, to explain the point that we're talking about, a word family sees each entry wider.
Mm.
So the word family for C would be see, seen, unseeable, because, you know, so you're now crossing word class.
Mm.
For the lemma, it would be smaller. It would be like see and seen and saw. So what happens is when you count by word family, you need less items.
Mm.
Right. So, and again, this is very, very, this is very broad, but if you have a text and you're counting by word family, 95% might be in the first 3,000, right? If you're counting by lemma, 95% might be in the first 5,000.
Right.
And that's where this kind of has a knock-on effect, you know. LEM is more accurate, but now you're getting, you know, there's more stuff to count. Or not more stuff, but just the absolute kind of values of what you're counting are going higher now.
Yeah. And is there one side of this, you know, snakes versus the jets question? Is there one side that's winning?
Yeah, it's interesting. And just our paper doesn't talk about this, so I want to be clear that I'm not an expert. But in Japan, the LEM is winning.
Mm-hmm.
And Japanese academics have offered a full-throated and successful defense, I would say. The argument in the Japanese context is that you can assume that because a learner knows the word see, they'll know the word unseeable. Right? Or something like that. If we look at context where the affinity or the closeness between the target language and the native language are closer, word family tends to be okay. So Laufer and colleagues have done research in Sweden, Israel, where they, I won't get into the nitty-gritty of it, but the data shows that word family is fine, or the assumptions that the word family makes work. But again, putting on my methods review hat, because I'm also a methodologist at heart, research in this area has to get better. And just the samples are too small. It's clear that maybe things are being massaged to get the results that people want.
I don't want to get into too much on the methodological or morality side.
It gets to be like kind of a windy road and kind of spirals.
But in relation to that, we kind of started with the concept that perhaps English for academic purposes is something that teachers will know about if they've gone through any kind of like ESL or TESOL training. Is there anything, as we kind of bring this interview to a close, that you would like to bring to light that listeners who are interested in this topic should take away from it? What they should think about in terms of how they choose their textbooks, how they prepare their classes, the activities they do in their classes, or materials that you can point the students towards.
Sure. So I guess the takeaway would be this: that if you're a EAP practitioner or a programmer, there is a wealth of research and applied science that has gone into supporting EAP materials development, course design, everything, and when you're choosing your textbooks or materials, it's important that you choose materials which have been informed by this research. And to give a positive example, I am a real big fan of Cambridge University Press products, and they have their issues, but they will overtly talk about how the English Profile Project informed what they're doing. And I know people who have written for Cambridge, and they will talk about, where their vocabulary words are given to them, where their materials are checked for appropriateness. Now, English Profile has its issues. Everything does. My work has its issues. I want to be clear here that we all live in glass houses as researchers. but if I were looking at a EAP textbook or vocabulary pack or something, the thing I would want to do is I would want to review the sales literature, the sales catalog, maybe even talk to a rep and say, how did you choose your vocabulary for this textbook?
Yes.
And, the project, the paper that we're talking about in very, very simple terms is, trying to present a way that could inform how vocabulary is chosen.
Mm-hmm.
Now, granted, this is quite, it's something that we did as a research project. It'd be unreasonable to expect a local publisher to do what we did. But if a local publisher changing from Cambridge to, let's say, a Japan-based publisher says, we looked at the AWL, and we checked it for cognates, and we checked it against, the COCA academic corpus, and using our selection process, we've selected 200 AWL words for the level 2 textbook that you're considering buying. That would be a publisher that I would place trust into. Right.
Well, I did a kind of similar thing post hoc.
Right. Because
I used a textbook that was relevant to the Japanese context when I was teaching in the business school. And that was produced by Sanseido, which is a Japanese publisher.
Right.
But I ran all of the text through LexTutor.
Right.
And the reason I did it, well, two reasons. One, to show that the textbook was actually fairly well leveled for the students that I had, but also to demonstrate to the students that I wasn't teaching them English. I was teaching them how to use English in a business context. And so they might have to write a website blurb, or they might have to respond to questions from a consumer overseas or something like that. And to show that the words that are used in mission statements, and as we would call them on websites, are sometimes full of unnecessary buzzwords because they look at sites from the USA, Canada, UK, South Africa, Australia, places like that, and they just kind of like incorporate this vocabulary which is inappropriate to either the context or the genre of communication.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I agree that if it isn't absolutely necessary to use textbooks that are sourced from overseas, and I agree with you with University Press that they do a very good job of leveling their work. But there is a way of taking domestically produced materials or producing materials domestically that takes into account everything that we've been speaking about today.
And I think that's right as well. I mean, my thesis was actually aimed at, trying to figure out what Cambridge did and presenting ways that local publishers could exploit what Cambridge was doing. But that thesis is tucked away in Belfast and it's not online, so no one will have the pleasure of reading it with a typo every page. So.
Well, before we finish, can I just ask you, why is your thesis not available online? Mine is on the White Rose database, and anyone can download it at any time.
I do not know. I submitted it according to what Queen's University Belfast wanted, and the abstract is online.
Mm.
But as I understand it, just the paper version is available in the library. So.
Well, I used to have a running joke with my godfather that, come the end of civilization, when there's no electricity and we need fire, burnable materials, the first thing that's going to go is the master's thesis in any university library. So, anyway. So, thank you very much for your time. The person we've been speaking today is Joe Vitter, and obviously good luck with your career in Waseda University.
Thank you.
And the paper we've been speaking about is Academic Word Difficulty and Multidimensional Lexical Sophistication, and English for Academic Purposes, Focused Conceptual Replication of Hashimoto and Egbert from 2019. So best wishes for everything.
Thank you.
There's a handshake, and I hope that we get the chance to meet each other many more times in the future.
We will see you on the conference circuit. Take care, everyone. Thank you.
If you'd like to contact the show, the best place to find out about us is our website, lostincitations.com. Here you can learn more about the background to this project and how you can get involved. Our hope is to help academics, educators, and online content producers get in contact with each other. Our email address is lostincitations@gmail.com. We also have Facebook and LinkedIn pages. Please rate and comment on the sites you use to download your podcasts. It helps us reach more potential listeners. But probably the most helpful thing you can do is, if you like our content, recommend it to a friend and let them know what we're trying to do. Thank you very much.